Children, we're starting.
That's right.
Showtime! Another Fresh Picked Pod from audiotou.com. Shutters Inc. with Shelton Muller.
You might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to episode 97 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from audiotou.com. With me on the line, not one of them, but two of them. We have Shelton Muller via Skype from Melbourne. And Landon Michelson via Skype from God knows where. Where are you, Landon?
I am in the middle of Washington, the state, in right. the United States.
Uh-huh.
So, how far from Bellingham are you, Landon?
About 4 hours.
Oh, okay, because that's the closest I've been to you, I think.
Yeah, about 2.5 hours east of Seattle.
Oh, okay. All right, there you go. There you go. Now, have you visited Kurt and Jimmy?
No.
Really?
I know okay. where they are, but no.
See, Shelton, you're on your own, man.
I haven't visited either of them either, but, you know, I don't live there. So, you know, I just thought I'd check. That's all.
Excellent.
No problem.
Well, it's good to have you on board, Landon. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting.
No, what time is it where you are?
That's only 8 o'clock p.m. here.
Oh, okay. Well, it's 2 o'clock p.m. here on yeah. Thursday, November the 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're a day behind us then, Landon, is that right?
Yeah, you're talking to me yesterday.
Wow. Look, it's terrific to have you on board. Now, I'm sorry to take over, Bruce. You are the man here, so
you right.
go for your life. I just thought I'd say g'day.
Because, yeah, you know, absolutely.
Isn't it great to have, you know, have someone else join us?
Absolutely. Definitely.
Yeah, I feel like yeah, I already know you. I've been listening to you 96 times.
Well, we think you're fantastic, mate. All our listeners, you know, and it's good to have you along. We're going to have to do this more often. Mind you, yeah. I can see myself losing my position.
I don't know about that.
I don't think that'll happen.
One by one, Bruce will work me out. We shall see. You don't know him like I know him, Landon. I'm running this show again, Bruce. You go right ahead, mate. I imagine we're going to talk to Landon today, as indeed we've said, about his long exposure techniques.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, you guys should just talk it out, and I'll just sit on the sideline.
Okay. Well, I haven't looked. You sent me an email, Bruce, a couple of days ago that I have just been so flat out trying to get hold of that there's a bit of a discussion on the Flickr site.
Yep.
Regarding the fact that, or not fact, but the notion that this dark frame. What do you call it?
Subtraction.
Dark frame subtraction. I had a shoot till like 11 o'clock last night, and I've been up since 6 this morning. So forgive my brain. I'm a little tired today. But dark frame subtraction isn't working. Have you read that yet, Landon?
I have not read that one, but I'll go check it out.
Yeah, get it. Because that indeed is what we're talking about. Landon, I imagine because you do a lot of long exposures, and the first thing that grabbed me, of course, was the fact that, you know, with digital has come this notion that long exposures, you know, of minutes or even hours is out of the question. And, you know, then I saw your work. I haven't had the chance, I must admit, in the years I've done digital, I haven't taken the chance to do some really long exposures. And then I saw yours and I thought, wow, these are beautiful. And I had the opportunity to go and do some myself this coming weekend. But you use dark frame subtraction. But can we take you right from the start? Of your technique for long exposures, do you have a particular when you embark upon the shot, what is it that you look for, or how is it that you establish yourself to make sure A, you know, the image is going to work as a time exposure, and you know, B, it will work in terms of its you know, accuracy, its logistics, exposure, etc.
I did some note-taking just to make sure I was ready for this. These are really quick. They're just bullet points, and I probably should cover these first so that people can write them down.
Mm-hmm.
And I can even email these to you, and you can put them in the show notes. But these are things that I do when I take long exposures to think of and be aware of and knowing how to approach it, because it really depends on subject matter, number one, time of day, number two.
Yep.
But these are general things that you can cover, and these will just take a minute. So you want me to go over them now?
Yes, please.
Okay, number one, use a sturdy tripod.
Mm-hmm.
$20 is not going to get you there.
No. Okay. What tripod do you use?
Well, I use a couple man Frodo's. I've had one of the years. Yep. It's my okay. one that I stick in the mud. I stick it in the sand. I stick it in the ocean. I stick it anywhere. I don't, you know, it yeah. doesn't matter where that one goes. And then I have a mm-hmm. studio one that's a little right. better looking that I take out to the weddings and the client gigs.
Right. Gotcha. Gotcha.
You use a cable release to go beyond 30 seconds, like you talked about last week.
Yes.
And $20 might get you there. Number three, charge your batteries and carry spares. Or use an AC adapter for really long exposures.
So, Landon, now you use a D200. I presume you have the battery pack.
Yes.
Yes? Okay, so you have two batteries in there. How do you go with power usage when you're out in the field? You're doing, you know, what, 4 or 5, maybe minute, maybe longer exposures. Do you find that you need to carry extra batteries with you, or do you have, you know, will they last long enough for you to do several exposures without any particular concern?
Well, the batteries that I keep with me, I always make sure I first go out with charged batteries.
Yes.
And then second of all, I have two of them. And I don't have any spares right now because I really haven't had a shoot where I've needed them. But I do carry the nickel metal hydride, you know, 25 milliamp. I've got about 40 of those things for my flash unit. So I can stick right. 6 of those in the cradle and put it in the camera on a pinch. But I haven't found it to be an issue. I can go out shooting all morning. You know, mm-hmm. it might go down to half hour. And then right. just stick them on the charger. And, you know, when I'm driving around, I have a AC to DC inverter. So I just stick them on there and charge them up again.
Okay. But it's really hasn't proven to be an issue for you so far.
Has not been an issue. I would imagine it would be an issue if I started doing a lot of 4 hour, you know, exposures.
What's the longest exposure then that you can remember doing with your D200 or any digital camera you've owned for that matter?
Yeah, about an hour and some odd minutes.
Right. And there were no how were your batteries after that kind of thing?
No, they were fairly depleted, but also keep in mind that it was about 18 degrees Fahrenheit when I was doing it too.
So. Right. Okay, so yeah, there's a bit of a drain there already then.
It keeps the sensor cold, so that helps.
Yes, and we're going to get to that. Now, I imagine that temperatures, you know, available temperatures, day temperatures, are fairly important, really. When we're talking about keeping a sensor cold, we're talking about reducing noise, essentially. So is there a better time of day? And what sort of difference have you found that it makes?
Well, I've seen some visual differences. I probably don't do enough tests, you know, to actually look at them side by side. But everybody knows that a hot sensor is more noisy than a cold sensor.
Right.
That's just a given.
Yeah.
But there's, of course, more to noise than just noise. You know, there's different types of noise, so we'll cover that too.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably going to be the issue. I would say most of our listeners would have a fairly good idea how to set up a long exposure. But yes,
question though before we move on.
Okay.
And that is, how do you meter for something that's that long an exposure? Is it just, you know, guesswork from years of experience, or do you use a light meter, or what do you do, Landon?
Well, here's two ways of doing it. One, it's trial and error.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, you just know it because you've done it a while. The other method is just bump your ISO way up. You know, take a test measurement, like at ISO 3200, 1600, somewhere up there,
yep.
just to get a reference point of what your histogram looks like.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you can calculate the stops.
Yeah, and then just reverse down the scale and figure out how many minutes you're going to have to do to get there.
Right.
Now, at ISO 100.
Now, do you have to measure in, as we did in the film days, for reciprocity failure in terms of exposure?
No, because digital is linear.
Yes. Okay. So there's no issue there. It is an absolute conversion from, you know, stepping down from your 1600 or 3200 test down to whatever ISO you choose to use, which I presume would be 100.
Yeah. Just count your stops and you're there.
Yeah. Okay. Terrific. Well, that's fantastic. So does that answer your question, Bruce?
Yep.
Yep. Beauty. Yep. Now let's talk about noise. Okay. Let's talk about noise, baby, and see what you've encountered. Sorry, I always sing. Landon, you'd know that by now.
I do.
Okay, now you've encountered, you know, different kinds of noise, I imagine. Let's run through them, and let's talk about the means by which you overcome them. So the most common one, I suppose, that you've encountered is just simply, you know, heat in the sensor due to the long exposure. Would I be correct in saying that?
Yes, often called thermal image noise.
Right. So your means of overcoming that, is there a way of overcoming that while you're on location, let's just not talk about dark frame subtraction yet. Let's say, okay, I will avoid that by doing this while I'm here as my first step. Like, for instance, you know, go down there in a cooler part of the day, for instance, or anything like that. Are there steps you take when you're actually taking the photographs to say, if I do this, there'll be less noise in the original image?
Well, you're going to have less noise at, you know, before sunrise than you will at high noon.
Yes.
Because it's going to be, your sensor's not going to get as warm. But you can also just do a simple menu function in your camera, if it has it, and many do, is just turn on long exposure noise reduction.
Mm-hmm. And that, have you found that, have you tested between the two?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does a dark frame subtraction for you. It just takes the shot immediately following your shot and does it itself and then saves it with the image.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay, so, and then you use that image when you, you know, when you basically get head back into Photoshop. Is that's
yeah, when you're not really concerned about controlling every nuance of the image, you can do it that way. Once you do more of it, then you realize what your workflow becomes, what you want and don't want.
Now, you were saying in your comment to me on the Flickr site that you actually do yourself, you take a second shot with a lens cap on or whatever. So, with the same length of exposure. So, that's you've decided to do that as against use the noise reduction in the camera? And if so, why?
Well, I'll give you it in a nutshell. At least with Nikon, I don't have that much experience with other cameras, but I do read a lot and listen a lot. But here it is in a nutshell. If you know what you're doing, you do not have to run long exposure noise reduction in the camera menu.
Right.
If you're just testing, if you're doing a few exposures, if you haven't done a lot of it, then just turn it on and use it. It helps.
Mm-hmm.
It does not reduce ISO noise.
Right.
You know, we're talking about thermal image noise.
Yes.
The sensor heating up, the hot pixels, the cold pixels, that stuff.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
So if you shoot a lot of long exposures, and a great example would be the people that shoot the night sky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that do astrophotography.
Yes.
What their typical workflow method is they know exactly what exposures they're doing commonly. They know how their sensor is at different, you know, climatic times of the year or whatever. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they have a series of dark frame subtractions that they've already recorded and saved.
Right.
So they just simply put the lens cap on, take a 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, 4 minute exposure, whatever it is, whatever their settings are that they need to have available.
Mm-hmm.
They just keep them on hand.
Right.
And they just shoot those once and have a library of them.
Now, does it not matter that they weren't in the same, you know, temperature conditions at the time of the shooting? They can revert to the same old dark frames that they've used before, even though the circumstances were different?
Well, of course it matters, but how much it matters in your workflow is really up to you.
Right.
You know, ultimately, you want to get them close. If you know you're shooting at, you know, it's 30 degrees outside Fahrenheit and you're shooting, you know, your sensor at that temperature, you know, for 3 weeks,
yeah,
then you only need one set of exposures to get you there. So
is that the method
it really
you
depends
use?
On, well, I have used it and I do have some on hand for like mm-hmm. the two and four minute ones. But for the 30 second, right. The 1 minute, I just usually just have noise reduction on. It just saves me a step. But there is a simple way to bypass it. So in my custom menu settings in the camera, there's four memory banks.
Right.
For my landscape memory bank, I have long exposure noise reduction set to on.
Mm-hmm.
But I can bypass that anytime I want. And mm-hmm. it's very simple. All you have to do is when it starts to do the not noise reduction on that image.
Yes.
Just flip the power off on the camera. It stops that process and saves the RAW for you. There's another benefit to doing that. And the Nikon RAW format apparently applies a mathematical median blurring filter to the image.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the low pass filter, to get around that, to get a true raw image, just flip the power switch off when it starts to go into noise reduction mode.
Right.
It'll quit doing it and just go ahead and save the raw file. So that's a way around that.
Right. Okay. All right.
And you can do that anytime you want. So.
Right. Okay. Fantastic. So then you. So basically, those are your steps when you're out in the field or down by the seaside.
Yeah, image gathering, that's the camera setting steps.
Yes, yes.
Of course, there's other settings too, but...
Okay, well, let's talk about them. You know, I mean, you're the expert. Let's talk about them.
Well, I was going to say, the next thing to do is shoot at your lowest ISO setting. Because if you're trying to get to a long exposure, you don't want to be shooting at ISO 800, you're not going to get there.
Yeah, well, you're going to get both temperature, noise, and and you know, high ISO nose, I suppose. So,
yeah, you remember 25-speed film?
Oh, do I? Yeah.
Remember how easy it was to get the long exposures with that stuff?
Yes. It was so easy. In fact, it was hard to do the other way around. But gee, it was gorgeous film, wasn't it?
Oh, I love that stuff. I used to get the deepest blacks and the nicest water, and it was great stuff. But then can't get any more. So
no,
I sold my film equipment too. So
yeah, me too. Well, is there a next step you do while you're on location?
Certainly. The next primary step would be neutral density filters.
Yes. Okay.
When you're trying to capture images in a field, and you have your ISO set where you want it, you have your aperture set for your depth of field that you want, now you need to control how much light is getting to that sensor, and you do that by using neutral density filters. Obviously, if you shoot at midnight, you have lots of time to gather an exposure, but if you're shooting at 7 in the morning, 10 in the morning, even high noon, how do you, you know, keep that light down so you can get long exposures?
Yes.
And the answer simply to that is just to use neutral density.
Right. Now, do you have a particular preference there?
Well, of course, if you're, you know, let's say that you meter a scene at ISO 100, you're at F11, and it says you're at 1/15th of a second.
Yeah.
Well, that's not very slow.
No.
So if you want to get to several minutes, you're going to have to go pretty deep in ND to get you there. And nine stops is going to get you to 30 seconds.
Yes.
10 stops is going to get you to a minute, and 11 stops is going to get you to 2 minutes. So now you're talking, you know, down around the range where I like to work.
Right. Okay. So you have do you have one particular neutral density filter you use most of the time, or do you use them in league with each other?
Well, yes, I do, and it really is first based on time of day.
Right.
If I have lots of light, then I'm probably going to pull out the ND400.
Mm-hmm.
If I have even more light, I might stack the ND400 with an ND, you know, ND3,
right?
You know, three stops of light. So now we're talking, you know, the ND400 is 8 2/3, which is almost 9. Pretty good. Right. That's a pretty good starting place. A friend of mine actually stacks two of those together.
Ah.
And, you know, in daylight to get down to like 4 minute exposures in daylight. So,
right. Is there a particular brand preference you have?
Well, you're going to not find very many. So I would just do a Google search on what's available. You're going to be searching ND400, ND10,000, you know, ND100 in those ranges to get you, depending on what light you shoot in. If you shoot, you know, pre-dawn, you don't might have to go that far, depending on how far of a shutter speed you want to go. But
yeah,
they're certainly nice to have in your kit.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Do you use polarizing?
It's amazing. Yeah, I do. I use a B+W, you know, multicoded. All my filters are multicoded just to keep down on, you know, all that light bouncing around off that high, you know, that low pass filter that's highly reflective. So
because a polarizer is a couple of stops in itself, you know. So
yeah, So that's about 1 2/3.
Yeah, yeah. So you would use, you know, that sort of would be a help. And if someone only had one, say, neutral density filter, they could think of using it, you know, in league with a polarizer, and immediately they're sort of getting the kind of f-stops or shutter speeds rather that they're wanting. You'd have no problem going right down to the smallest aperture, or do you come back for sharpness to avoid diffraction, that kind of thing?
Well, here's the next thing, you know, that's on my list is don't use small apertures with small format cameras if you care about sharp images.
That's what I thought I'd ask, yeah.
You know, if you want to be shooting at even a full-frame, quote-unquote full-frame sensor, you don't want to be shooting past f/16 if you want sharp images.
Yeah.
So, you know, typically you need to find the sharpest aperture of your lenses. You need to know depth of field. You need to know a little bit about hyperfocal. You need to know how to overcome it or bypass it to meet your workflow. But you do not want to be... You know, even if, like that example I gave at 1/15th at F11, even if you drop it to F32, you're only at 1 second. So you're not going to get to 1 minute by changing your aperture.
Yeah, no, that's right.
All you're going to do is get a soft image.
So, you'd avoid, say, going to, you know, 22, 32 in your apertures. F16 is probably where you'd stop.
Pretty much, you know, it depends on the lens. Usually I try to stop around F11, F13. I push it to F16 if I really need depth of field for a working shot. But there's ways around digital capture to get over that problem of depth of field. You just take two exposures, one for the background, one for the foreground, and merge together where the line is. So,
okay. All right. Well, so there's another step then. You do on location. That's one of them. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Oh, certainly. When you're in the field, you only have one chance to capture it.
Yes.
So you can do it. You can process it 153 different ways, but you can only capture it one.
Yes.
So if you capture the entire depth of field that you want, if you can capture all of the exposure values that you need, you've done all of your proper exposing in the field, so you have everything you come back with at the, you know, you sit down in Lightroom or Photoshop or whatever your current tools of the day are, you have all the data you need to pull out whatever you want out of that image.
Yes.
So in the field, it's just a matter of trying to capture everything you can get at once. You know, the light is fleeting, the moment's fleeting, you know, water levels change, moons move, tides come in, go out. There's lots of things that happen over 4, 6, 10, 12, 15 minutes or hours, you know, that happen to the scene. So what you're trying to do is capture all of that you can in the quickest possible time as you can.
Okay.
Without being in a hurry.
Yeah. Right. And I suppose that, you know, all jokes aside, there is something about just stopping, taking a breath, thinking it through, you know, before you just rush into sort of setting up the tripod, composing, chucking in a filter, and off you go. You know, there's a fair bit of thought that I'd imagine you'd put into every image before you embark upon actually pressing the shutter release button.
Yeah, like anything that's worthwhile, most of the endeavor happens long before you get there.
Yeah.
By the time you get there, you've already planned what you're doing. All you're doing is being there before the moment happens, so when it happens, you're ready.
You're ready. Yeah, true.
I was just going to say, the nice thing about the long exposure workflow is it forces you to slow down. It forces you to think, because the last thing you want to do is do an 8-minute exposure and then find out, oh, well, that didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, now your light's gone.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, Bruce, if there's a crooked horizon, Bruce will just go nuts. You know? So you'd have to, make sure it's, you know, you that's perfectly correct. I wouldn't mind a little more detail on your process of depth of field over your two images. Can you tell us a little more about that in technical terms?
Well, certainly. I mean, let's say you're shooting at, 10 millimeters on a crop factor sensor or 15 millimeters on a full frame sensor.
Yep.
And you've got your foreground locked for hyperfocal distance. Now, if you want to drop down to f/22 to get the whole thing sharp, now you're worried about diffraction. So all you really need to do is shoot one shot with the foreground and middle ground, you know, basically in depth of field, fully in focus, and then shoot one for the background and merge the two together.
Right. Okay. And that's just a simple process you do in layers in Photoshop?
Yeah. You just throw them together and merge the two together with a quick layer mask, and then, you know, you can tell it exactly where you want.
Right. Yep. Fantastic. So next step, Landon, the next step that you would do?
The next step would be aware of the fourth dimension, time.
Mm-hmm.
What does time do to the scene? The water, the moon, you know, the sky, the light, the objects, you know, is the water rising? Is it going lower? You have to be aware of things, because even where you put your tripod matters a long exposure. I was doing a test at the ocean, and I'd set up for a shot. I was doing a 4-minute exposure with infrared, and ocean came up and undermined one of my tripod legs in the middle of the exposure.
So what actually happened?
Well, it ruined the shot.
Nothing damage to your equipment, I hope.
No, just 2 minutes in, it moved half an inch.
Don't you love it?
And of course, you wouldn't have noticed that at the time, would you?
No, I didn't notice it at the time. Yeah. I thought, you know, I'd pushed the tripod legs firmly into the sand far enough, but, you know, the ocean's a lot stronger than my tripod legs. So.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so that's excellent advice. Okay, so we're in the process. Next step.
Expose properly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's no more critical with a 100,000th of a second versus 4 minutes. You still have to expose properly.
Yep.
You know, if your shadows are dark, you're going to get noise. Mm-hmm. If your highlights are blown, they're blown.
They're blown.
You know, you got to capture it right in the field. Just because it's a long exposure doesn't mean you can just throw things out the window. But the longer the exposure, the more room you have for error. If you go over a couple seconds, you won't even notice it, you know, in a 4-minute exposure. So you have more more room for error, but you still have to capture it, right?
Yes. Okay. Terrific.
Landon, I've got a question for you, and I'm not sure if I've posed this to Shelton in the past or not. I notice with my Konica Minolta 7D, if I take say, a 15-second exposure. At the end of the exposure, it takes the camera probably another 15 seconds to write the file. Is that common to all digital SLRs?
No. Here's what you'll find in some cameras is that green light will come on the back that tells you it's writing to the card.
Yep.
What it's really doing is doing a dark frame subtraction on that image and then saving it. So usually, you know, beyond 10 seconds, the cameras that have that setting enabled will then, you know, do a noise reduction process on it and then save it. On the Nikons, what happens is you do your shot, and then it says job NR, you know, in the window. Mm-hmm. And then when that goes away, then the light comes on and saves it to the card. So
right.
It takes just the same amount of time to expose the image as it does to do the dark frame subtraction. So if you do an 8-minute exposure and an 8-minute dark frame, and you're looking at a 16 minutes before you get to see the shot.
Okay. Get your thermos flask out and have a cup of coffee.
Yeah. There is a workaround for that, though.
Yes.
Shoot with two or three bodies.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Do you do that?
When one's sitting there working on the tripod, working away, doing a long exposure, I'm often investigating the next shot with the other digital SLR body to see what I'm framing in next, what I want to do, the light's fading, I want to get this rock on the shot, that type of thing. So.
Okay. All right. Now, is that a D200 also?
No, I've got a D70 and a D40X as backup bodies that I play around with. The D200 is the workhorse.
Yeah.
But the D40X is a nice little camera I can shove in all kinds of small places. The D200 doesn't fit, and it's got the same sensor size, so it just fits the workflow nice.
They are actually an impressive little camera.
I've been pretty happy with that little thing. There's certain things it can't do.
No.
But, you know, usually it's just figuring out how to make it do what you want it to do.
Yeah, usually there's a way around.
But, you know, both cameras are... All the cameras are set up in manual mode 95% of the time, so you know it's not hard to get something out of it.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so what's your next step then, Landon?
You know, like I already talked about, taking a test shot at high SIO to check everything, but that's kind of important because what you want to do is make sure that your exposure is going to be on when you get it recorded.
Right.
And the next thing to do is if you can't get it exposed properly in one shot, bracket.
Yes.
I usually do the longest exposure first. Because as the light's fading, you know, I can get if I need a 4-minute exposure to get the shadows recorded,
right?
I can quickly do a 2-minute and a 1-minute, you know, while the light's not quite there,
right? Whereas the other way around, it's
hard to work the other way.
Yeah. Now, will you merge the images with HDR at any particular time? Would you, you know, would you say take a 4-minute and then a 1-minute or whatever, or bracket them and then use HDR later on for those things?
I do employ HDR tools in my workflow, but I do not use them as the end result. Okay. I simply have a process I've nicknamed hybrid exposure compensation because to me that's what I'm doing. I'm using multiple tools to compensate for exposure control on a limited sensor. So what I'm doing is I'm bracketing the shots. I'm making sure I capture all of the information that is in the scene. I look at the histogram, make sure all the shadows are captured, all the highlights are captured, everything in the middle. Mm-hmm. I take all that out of the field. I run some of the processes through HDR tools. I output a couple different exposures, one for the sky, one for the ground plane, maybe three, depending on where the highlights or shadows are. And then I'll merge those with a couple basic, you know, layer masks and some custom routines to get it fitting into my workflow the way I want it to come out, the way I saw the image, or at least the way I felt about seeing the image.
Right, yes. Yes. So the images that we see of yours, say, on your Flickr site, are any of those basically the result of just one frame, or have most of them been the result of two or three?
Here's a trick for you. If it's not in an HEC, you know, group in my little Flickr site, if it's not in that set of photos, then it's a single exposure.
Okay. All right.
If it's a bracketed exposure with two or more exposures, sometimes you might need nine, but typically those scenes aren't very nice to begin with. So typically 3 to 5 exposures, one exposure part gets me there.
Okay. All right. Do you have any issues with, you know, because movement is involved because of time, do you have any issues in merging the images and having, you know, certain things move on you that you didn't necessarily want to move on you? I mean, the things you want to move will move, but there'll be some things that maybe a tree or whatever that you'll want to be fairly static that might actually move because of breeze or wind or anything like that. I mean, are those issues that you constantly face?
Yes, and the one that I've been facing the last couple of weeks is along the Columbia River. The water level keeps rising and dropping during the exposure. So it's, I mean, I'm talking like 4 to 8 inches sometimes.
Oh, okay.
So it, you know, I'm sitting there. I've got these nice rocks framed in the way I want it to with the dawn sunrise, you know, that's going to come up, and the water level's dropping, or the water level just covered my rocks. So,
right.
You know, and then from one to the next, it changes. So, yeah, there's some things to be aware of. Surf is another good one that, you know, changes your dynamics a lot. But trees can move. You know, if you're there long enough, all kinds of things can move.
Yeah.
Even the sun can move. So your shadows can move.
Yes, very true.
But
very
it is, true. You know, time is something to be aware of, and you can use it to your advantage.
Mm.
You just have to be aware of what your limitations are. Mm-hmm. How to overcome them and what you want out of the image. I mean, you could shoot a 1/500th of a second shot of the tree limbs and then composite it in if you want them sharp, but sometimes having them moving too adds another dimension to the photo. So it really depends on what you're after.
That's really what we're talking about, isn't it? I mean, we are talking about the passage of time, you know? So, you know, those things really, you've got to accept that those are part of that process. And, you know, it may not be the issue that, you know, you've got to let it go, I suppose, is what I'm saying. You've got to let it be what it is. And
Or be creative with it.
Yeah, true. All right. So we've have we finished on location yet? Or is there more you make sure of?
That's pretty much it. Just make sure your images are backed up and you don't go heading off into the toolies with leaving anything behind.
Fair enough. Now, okay, so let's go into your Photoshop process and the dark frame subtraction your process there. Can we talk about that? Just so we can get it absolutely clarified for those who listen and for, of course, the situation that's being discussed with on Flickr.
Certainly. Number one, the easiest way to do it, set noise reduction in your camera. The image coming into your workflow is already passed through the dark frame subtraction process. You don't have to worry about it. It's already there.
Mm-hmm.
Next level of complexity, you shoot your own dark frame subtraction sets. You have them in your library, and you merge those in Photoshop with layers, as you discussed last week.
Yep.
You know, difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is another method too that's commonly done, and it works as well. So there's, you know, like anything with Photoshop, there's usually 10 ways to do one thing.
Yes. What's that one, Landon? That because we've talked about dark frame subtraction. I think it's a matter of people actually getting out and giving it a try, and they'll find that it certainly does work. But you've got another method that you also use.
Well, I've used it before. You know, I don't use it a lot, but there's another method called the apply image operation.
Yes.
And you can apply the image with the dark field with the light field and merge the two together, and it does pretty much the same thing. So, yeah, like I said, I don't do it a lot, so it's not really in my current workflow, but I got some notes here that, you know, basically your black field image is your source, your layer is your background, and then you do a blending subtraction at opacity 100. And you're basically just trying to tell the merge that you're going to take the difference between these two and merge the two together so that it takes the highs and lows and merges them down into a basically 50% range area. So it cuts out a lot of that.
I've been reading a lot recently about the Photoshop stacking. Is it a similar process to that?
Yeah, and CS3 Extended has a lot of things that can benefit photographers that weren't meant for photographers, but there's all kinds of things in there that are kind of fun to play with. So that is another method of doing multiple exposures. If noise is truly random, then you take a bunch of images, merge them together, and what you get is less noise in the end.
Yes.
There's lots of different ways to control noise. Basically, you just need to figure out in your workflow what the noise is, how to control it, how much you can live with, how much you need to get rid of.
Yep, fair enough.
Because it's not the same for everybody, but not all noise is the same.
Mm.
So, you know, dark frame noise is basically current, you know, thermal current noise. So that's one process of your workflow to get rid of that.
Yes.
ISO noise is completely different.
Yes, yes. And of course, dark frame subtraction is not applied. It does not apply there.
Now, it actually doesn't do much of anything to grain at all.
No.
It just basically unfogs that mess that the signals bouncing around did.
Yeah. Now, do you use any noise reduction software like Noise Ninja or anything like that?
I was going to say I'm not a huge fan of it either, but when you need it, you need it. Here's my basic rule of thumb on that. For me, my client workflow, when I do portraiture, weddings, commercial work, hardly any of it ever touches Photoshop anymore. It goes in Lightroom and it comes out of Lightroom, and Photoshop never gets touched.
Yeah.
But for fine artwork, for controlling layers, for doing, you know, ultimate control of things, certainly there's still a Photoshop workflow that exists, and noise reduction is part of that. You know, I've used Noise Ninja more frequently. I've used Neat Image in the past. I just find with the D200 sensor that Noise Ninja does a better job for me.
Right.
But I'm selectively applying noise reduction when I apply it. It's yes. not an all or nothing deal. I don't just throw it on an image and, you know, and get out plastic out the other end.
Yeah,
I'm controlling it in the shadows. I'm controlling it in the highlights. I'm making sure the details don't get soft. I'm making sure it doesn't get over sharpened. Mm. You know, and it's subject dependent. It's image dependent. There's a lot of things. So it, there isn't just one setting that works for everything.
You don't want to apply. Yeah, exactly. And it's good to hear that, you're shooting to create the image successfully in the camera, so that all you're really needing to do is Lightroom processes, which is, you know, very commendable. You know, that's terrific.
Yeah, but when you're pushing the envelope, you got to do other things sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no crime in any. It's just it's nice to hear someone actually saying, you know, that there are a lot of his images that don't touch Photoshop. That's that's terrific, because in the old film days, mate, that's the way it had to be.
Most of the images that the client sees never touch Photoshop, unless I'm doing something highly creative or a bunch of exposure compensation, you know, on an image just to get artistic. Yeah. If it's artistic, it usually ends up in Photoshop from Lightroom. Mm-hmm. But Lightroom's just the beginning step, and for client work, it's usually the beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
Photoshop's just there in case there's an issue with a file or something where I need to merge two heads, or you know, the smile was wrong, some of the eyes were closed, and you know, you took 14 exposures, but Uncle wouldn't open his, you know, his eyes for nothing.
I had to remove an entire person out of a family lineup once because the marriage broke up. But that's a whole nother story. But look, Landon, one final question: should any of our listeners want to just ask you any refinement questions, you know, or they haven't perfectly understood what we've talked about today, would you be open to talking with them via your Flickr site or them asking you any particular questions?
I do that every day, so I'm freely, you know, open to whatever question somebody has.
Oh, that's fantastic. There you go.
If I have the answer, I'll share it. If I can find it, I'll share it.
Oh, good on you. Oh, sounds like you're very much like me, Matt, that you get the emails every day. I'm having this little bit of a problem, and it's actually a great thing that people feel free to contact you and ask that question. And it's a wonderful industry wherein we can help each other to do that. You know, terrific.
There's people out there helping me still, and I'm still learning every day, so all I can do is pass it along to other people that need an answer, so...
That makes the world go round, doesn't it? Good on you, mate. That's terrific. Bruce, I imagine we're about at wrap-up time, unless you have any final questions for Landon?
No, probably the only thing would be, Landon, you mentioned earlier on about finding the optimal aperture for the particular lens that you're working with, that if you go too small an aperture, you get fuzzy. How do you identify that sweet spot in the lens? Is it just by doing some tripod exposures at each aperture to work out where the sharp point is? Is it that easy?
It there actually is some tests that you can do too to actually find maximum sharpness of your lens and actually find out if there's problems with the lens. Mm. And there was another podcaster that had a recent episode that covered some of those topics. You know, if you just search for it, you know, there's some charts and graphs you can shoot in your home studio and test all your lenses at all the apertures, and you can find out for yourself which one's the sharpest one.
Cool.
Usually it's a case of, you know, your smallest aperture and then go back two or three. I mean, that's a very general rule of thumb.
Right.
But the smallest aperture will give you diffraction. So, you know, it is a bit of a problem. But we can perhaps even talk about that in a future podcast, Bruce.
For sure.
Basic rule of thumb for me is the more critical your work is, the more you need to know.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, very true. Very true. Landon, we really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure everyone listening really appreciates your input. There has been some invaluable stuff you've mentioned, things that many of us wouldn't have thought of, that we've, you know, gained the benefit from your experience as a result of. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's really been terrific.
It has been.
Thank you very much. That's terrific. We're going to have to do this again sometime, I reckon.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Okay, just a reminder, we're still looking for more submissions for the landscape competition. Mm-hmm. And we've had a few more come in, which is great. At this point in time, it is now Thursday, 8 days away from when I fly out to the States. I don't know whether or not we're going to get to record another podcast before I go.
Really?
Because I'm going to be flat out next week. We'll see how we go. We will aim to do it.
Okay.
We will aim to do it next Thursday, but we'll just have to play it by ear. It may be case of I drop you a phone call on the morning and say, mate, I'm sorry, I just can't.
That's fine.
With any luck, people, we will get another episode out before I go. But if we don't, I will certainly blog and let you know that there won't be.
Okay. The life of the jet setters.
Yeah. And I think that's just about it from me.
Terrific.
Shelton, anything you wanted to cover?
I am so stoked to have had Landon on today. And again, thank you very much for coming on board, mate. That's been really terrific. And I hope all our listeners share in some way or another in thanking you for your kindness.
Absolutely. Thank you, Landon.
Thanks for the invite.
No worries. Pleasure.
We'll do this again. Good on you. Thanks, Bruce. All Thanks, right. Landon.
We'll talk to you next week.
You bet.
See ya.
See you soon.
Bye.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.